Conversations with Apollo, episode number 15, the MSFN.
In the whole history of man, this has to be the proudest day of our lives. Because of what you have done, the heavens have become a part of man's world.
This week on Conversations with Apollo, we're talking about NASA's Manned Spaceflight Network with Brian Real. Brian has 35 years of experience in computer systems, including 21 years in the air traffic control automation systems for the Federal Aviation Administration. But before that, he worked on the NASA Manned Spaceflight Network, including working on the Apollo tracking stations in Guam and Corpus Christi, Texas. Brian, thanks for joining us on Conversations with Apollo.
Yeah, good morning.
So tell me, Brian, tell me about the tale that brought you to NASA. And did you look around and you realize you're in Guam? It's like, how am I here?
Well, it's a kind of a strange story, Jim. When I got out of high school, I went into the United States Navy, and they sent me through electronic school down in Key West, Florida, and I was on a destroyer for several years. And when I got out of the Navy, I went back to my hometown in Columbus, Ohio, and I got a job as a computer technician with North American Aviation there in Columbus, which is now North American Rockwell. And I was working as a computer technician, and I enrolled in Ohio State University on the GI Bill. And I had been doing that for a couple of years. And in the summer of 1965, I saw an advertisement in the newspaper that said NASA and the Bendix Field Engineering Corporation were hiring engineers and computer technicians for the Apollo program. And they listed all of the remote sites that were to become Apollo tracking stations. And they had some pretty nice looking places on there, like Bermuda and Antigua and Grand Bahamas and the Azores and over in Spain and Hawaii and this place called Guam that I had never heard of before.
That honeysuckle tracking station in Canberra.
Friend of mine went down and interviewed with them, and they gave him a job in Bermuda. So I went down a couple of days later and asked if they had any more openings on Bermuda, and the guy laughed and he said, "No, we just hired your friend for that, but we need somebody to go to Guam." So I said, "Well, I've never heard of Guam before. What is it?" And he says, "It's an island out in the Pacific. And we're going to build a tracking station out there from the ground up." So I called my father, who had been in the U.S. Marines during World War II, and he had been in the Pacific. And I asked him about Guam, and he started laughing. And he says, "You probably don't want to go to Guam." But to make a short story long, I was offered a job by Bendix Field Engineering to go to Guam. So I quit my job at North American. I dropped out of school at Ohio State University, and Bendix sent me down to Wallops Island, Virginia in the fall of 1965 to go through a 3 or 4 month computer school. And as it turns out, the computer that they wanted to train me on was one that I had been working on for several years at North American, which is probably one of the reasons they offered me the job. But I went down to Wallops Island, Virginia to a computer school, and right after the first of the year in 1966, I flew out to Guam, and I stayed out there for about 5 years. Working on the Apollo program, on all of the launches that occurred up through and including Apollo 13. And after Apollo 13, That's when I went to Corpus Christi, Texas, and I was there for Apollo 14. And after Apollo 14, there was talk of the space program winding down, and some friends of mine worked for Sperry UNIVAC up in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and they told me that the Sperry UNIVAC company had just gotten a big contract with the Federal Aviation Administration to install 60-some automated radar tracking systems in the nation's largest airports. And that was this computer they were using there was the next generation of the one that we had used on the Apollo program. So that was a natural job fit for me there. So I resigned from Bendix and went to work for UNIVAC, and eventually ended up with the FAA. But I'm kind of jumping ahead of myself. I know we want to talk about the things that happened on Guam during the Apollo program. And if you'd like to go back and talk about that, I'm certainly ready to do that.
Well, take me through the nature of the manned spaceflight network, the whole tracking system. Can you kind of paint a broad picture over how it works and how it's connected? Just not too technical, but just give us a highlight of what the manned spaceflight network really is.
Okay. Well, let's start with the sites themselves. As I recall, Jim, there were 13 sites. There was one at Merritt Island, right there where the Saturn V lifted off. And just if I can, I'm kind of doing this off the top of my head from memory. We'll just go downrange from the launch site. Merritt Island, as soon as it lifted off, Bermuda picked it up. They had Grand Bahamas, they had Antigua as it went on downrange. They had Ascension Island, then Madrid, Spain picked it up, and then they had some ships out there in the Indian Ocean that would get it. Then it would come over Australia, so Honeysuckle and Canberra. It would be headed from west to east over the Pacific Ocean then, and Guam would see it, and then Hawaii. It would approach the west coast of the United States, and then we had Goldstone in California. And then there was a tracking station in Corpus Christi, and then it would be back over Merritt Island and the Caribbean again.
And then start all over again.
And it would start all over again. And they would normally launch at about a 70-degree launch azimuth out of the Cape. So it was kind of in a equatorial orbit. And of course, you know, there are a lot of variations to that, but that was essentially, excuse me, that was essentially what comprised the manned spaceflight tracking network. And most of the sites on the network had a 9-meter parabolic antenna. We called them 30 feet, but they were actually 9 meters. And we would track them in near Earth orbit, and the antenna would also track them all the way to the moon. So after a liftoff from the Cape, typically, let's talk about Apollo 11 or 12 when they actually went to the moon. They would lift off, and typically they would be in the Earth orbit for two or three orbits, and then they would reignite the Saturn, and they would go on out to the moon. I don't think they ever went more than two or three orbits before they reignited to escape the Earth's gravitational field and go to the moon. But it took about 90 minutes for them to do an Earth orbit. So typically, a ground station would see them once every 90 minutes when they stayed in Earth orbit. But once they started their translunar injection on their way out to the moon, we could watch them literally for 12 hours. Well, it's just like, you know, when the moon comes up over the horizon, it's up for 12 hours and it sets. Well, when they're on their way, when the spacecraft was on its way to the moon, they would come up over the horizon and we would track them for 12 straight solid hours until they disappeared over the other horizon. And it took, as I recall, it took a couple of days for them to get out there before they went into lunar orbit. And once they were in orbit around the moon, as long as the moon was up and wherever you were, you could track the spacecraft as he was going around the moon. When he was on the Earth side of the moon, when he was around behind the moon, of course, we got no signals whatsoever.
And during this time, what was your job?
Well, when there was not a spacecraft flying, my job was, in the beginning, I was a computer technician. And
of course, computers were dramatically different back then.
You know, the computers that we had were made by UNIVAC, and they were called 642B computers. And they had been developed for the Navy tactical data systems for on shipboard use. And the ones that we had at the tracking stations were the same old water-cooled computers that the Navy used on the ship. Now, one of the interesting things about it was that these computers, we had two of them on each site, one for command and one for telemetry. And they were the size of a big double-sized refrigerator freezer that you go down and buy now. And they only had 32K of memory in them. If you can imagine that, it's just mind-boggling that we had computers back then, and this was pretty much the state of the art. And they only had 32,000 memory addresses in them. Now, today you're talking 64 gigabytes or some darn thing like that, you know?
Yeah, if you went back in time, you could probably run the whole program on a couple of iPhones.
Oh, well, you know, it's kind of interesting. You know these birthday cards that you go down and you pay $8 for, and you open them up, and they sing happy birthday to you.
Yeah.
There's more computer power in one of those birthday cards than existed in the whole world in 1950. Now, we went to the moon in 1969. So, you know, that was less than 20 years after 1950. And it's just incredible how much we did with so little technology back in those days.
Yeah, it is amazing to think of the core rote memory of the Apollo guidance computer and how it only, I think it was only 16K, and they had to use nouns and verbs to translate things and
well, that was the tightest. I've read that the code in the onboard computer was the tightest, best written code in the history of the universe, and I'm sure that's true. That they could get so much accomplished with so little memory. Absolutely incredible.
Yeah, it's mind-boggling to imagine. It's like I heard sometime that the Voyager spacecraft, which is on its way out of our solar system now, visited like 9 out of the 10 planets in our solar system, or 7 out of the 10 of our solar system. Took hundreds of thousands of pictures, did complex scientific calculations and experiments and everything, and it did it all on less memory than is in a digital watch.
Mm-hmm. It's
truly amazing. Truly amazing what we did then, and wondering why we're not doing it now. But we're jumping ahead of ourselves. So your job was basically to maintain the systems during the flight?
Well, they were very reliable. We would put in...
of course, it was all solid state back then, wasn't it?
No, absolutely not. There was no solid state whatsoever.
Oh.
Well, let's talk about that for a minute, Jim. The computers that we had, the 642B computers we had, were transistors and diodes. There was no microprocessors back in those days. And that's why they were so big. And we also had a UNIVAC 1218 computer, which was an 18-bit computer that was used to position that 9-meter antenna. But the main processor computers were the UNIVAC 642Bs, and they were all diodes and transistors. There were no integrated circuits in them whatsoever. That's why they were so huge. It wasn't until the next generation of computers that Sperry UNIVAC started using medium and large scale integrated circuits.
Yeah, that's a company name you don't hear anymore, Sperry UNIVAC. I remember when growing up, UNIVAC was like almost the dictionary definition of the word computer you thought of was UNIVAC.
Yeah.
And then the personal computer revolution took off, and then UNIVAC just disappeared.
Mm-hmm. Well, they never took much of a corporate interest in that part of the business. They were pretty much dedicated to the military. And I've kind of lost track of what they've done as far as manufacturing hardware in the last 15 or 20 years. But after the space program, they had this big contract with the Federal Aviation Administration to put in what were called ARTS-3, which is an automated radar tracking system. The acronym ARTS means automated radar tracking system. And they sold those to the Federal Aviation Administration in the early middle 70s. And then that piece of their business with the FAA pretty much kept their technical staff in Minneapolis busy for years after that. They chased follow-on contracts with the FAA and with the military. But they just never, ever had any interest in getting involved in personal computers and things like that. And I really don't know why. I guess it was because they just had a business model that was focused on other things.
Well, back then, a lot of people didn't see the practicality of it, really. I mean, it really, you know, if you read the biographies of Bill Gates and Steve Jobs and how they brought the personal computer revolution to it, they got a lot of pushback from companies that just you know, didn't see it. You know, Steve Jobs was able to get the precursor. Was able to get the precursor of the Apple operating software. For he was able to buy it from Xerox for a song, because the engineers at Xerox just thought it was a pet project, and nobody saw what it would become. Nobody thought that people would want a computer that would take up their entire house.
It was kind of like the Swiss not jumping onto digital wristwatches.
Yeah, you know, it's just and it just took, you know, a couple of crazy guys with a vision to make it smaller and change the world, I guess. So now, at the risk of, usually when I ask this question, I either get Apollo 11 or Apollo 13. So tell me, what was the highlight of the program for you?
The highlight of the program for me was when the Eagle landed. And that, of course, that was Apollo 11. But we were on the other side of the world when the Eagle landed, and we knew since the moon was not up on Guam, we weren't required to be at work. But there were four or five of us who decided we were not going to miss that minute for anything in the world. And we all lived about 20, 25 miles from the tracking station. And even though we didn't have to be at work, we drove out there, and it must have been 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning on Guam when the Eagle landed. And we went back into the comm center and got the Capcom and the Houston network up on the speakerphone so we could hear it. And we sat there kind of in the dark listening to Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin land that thing. And of course, Charlie Duke was the Capcom. And I'm sure you've heard, have you ever heard that particular?
Yeah, the infamous line where he says, you got a bunch of guys about to turn blue or breathing again.
You got a bunch of guys about to turn purple down here. We were a bunch of grown men sitting there crying like babies when they landed on the moon. And to me, that was the highlight of the whole thing.
How about the low period for you? What was the worst thing about your Apollo experience? If there was one.
Yeah, this is almost sacrilegious, but the worst thing to me about the Apollo program was after Apollo 11, they left this thing called an ALSEP package up on the moon. And ALSEP is an acronym for Apollo Lunar Surface Experimental Package. And it continued sending data back to the Earth after the Apollo 11 splashdown. And we had to keep coming back to work to collect data on that daggone thing.
So everybody else was partying and you had to.
Well, yeah. I mean, it just, and to me, I wasn't too interested in the scientific data that they were collecting from this ALSEP package. So that was kind of a bummer. It took all the fun out of it. But, you know, I don't know that I ever really had a low period. I don't have too much of a recollection of any personal trauma associated with Apollo 13. I know we were all concerned about what was going on, and but we got them home. Well, I didn't have anything to do with getting home. You know, the guys down in Houston.
Well, you kept the lights on.
Well, we tracked them and shipped data, but I don't recall having any real bad feelings about anything that happened while I was out there.
So you were what, about 25, 26?
I was in my middle 20s, yes.
Well, that's a heady time to be halfway around the world by yourself and doing some crazy things.
Well, you know, it was kind of, let me talk about some crazy things and then I'd like to go back and talk about the tracking network again.
Absolutely.
Or we can talk about the tracking network now, and then I can talk about crazy things later.
However you want to do it, Brian. It's your hour.
Well, we were on talking about the network. Our tracking station, and this is pretty typical, I think it had about 100 people on it. And on one end of the building, we had the USB section, which is Unified S-Band, which was the antenna and all the transmitting receiving equipment. And in the middle of the building, we had the telemetry and the recording section. And in the other end of the building, we had the computer room and the control consoles and the communication system. And we had our own diesel generator building for backup power so that we always had electricity and lights. And we had a supply room. And, we had our own little kitchen where we could cook food and stuff like that. And most of the guys that worked on the tracking station were ex-military who had gotten some kind of electronic training in the military. And I think that's probably true of every site on the network. The guys who gravitated into those jobs were ex-military radar computer communications people. That was kind of the place where industry went to get the skill set they needed to do high tech work back in those days. And we were a diverse bunch of people. I used to tell people the reason I went to Guam was because I heard that rum and coke were only 60 cents a piece out there. And we partied hard. And we had a good time, and we worked our butts off during the missions. There were periods of time when the moon was on the other side of the world, so we didn't have to go to work.
So at what point in the mission timeline did you actually join NASA? Did you join NASA at the beginning of Apollo, or? I'm trying to figure out where you are from mission to mission. What was your first mission?
My first mission was, I guess it was the first launch of the Saturn V, and it was unmanned. I think. Let me look here. I have a thing on the wall here. Let me walk over and take a look at it.
So that would be the Apollo, the unmanned testing that was done. That would probably be what Apollo 2, I would imagine, because two through six were unmanned test flights of the Saturn V. Am I correct?
Yes, we supported all of those.
Yeah.
In fact, I was on Guam when the crew got killed down on the launch pad.
Oh, you were on duty then?
Oh, yeah.
What are your thoughts?
Well, that was a sad day.
Yeah.
I kind of pushed that out of my mind. I was out there working. There was no active mission at the time. I went to Guam in January of 1966, and we didn't even have the building completely occupied with equipment then. We were still installing the computers and stuff and running integration tests on it after I got there. And you know, I'd have to get on the internet and do some research. I don't know when we supported our first live mission. It was one of the early Saturn shots that was unmanned. I do know that we did track that. And the
unmanned flights were all what they called all up testing, where they tested everything all at the same time. They tested the lunar module. They tested the command module, the launch systems, everything all at once.
I don't remember those details. I do remember that I think it was Apollo. I think Cernan went up on Apollo 7 and he flew the limb out of around the moon, but they never tried to go down and land.
Yeah, that was Apollo 10.
No, it was Apollo. Yeah, that was Apollo 10. I do remember during Apollo 7 at this, it was in the summer of 1968, and right after the splashdown, we got a message, a teletype message. It came out of Houston that said, we expect to be at the moon at Christmas time. And that was the first hint they gave us that Apollo 8 was going to go to the moon at Christmas.
Boy, that must have been an exciting message.
Oh, it was. It was. I used to have a copy of that, but I sold it at an auction for some space memorabilia several years ago.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that stuff is always popular.
But
the only memorabilia that I always wanted to get would be the checklist from Apollo 12 that were on the cuff checklist of Pete Conrad and Al Bean, because it had Playboy Playmates in it.
Yeah, that'd be worth something.
But yep. So you supported the unmanned flights, and your first manned flight was Apollo 7 with
Yeah, if that was the first manned flight, yeah, I was there for all of them up through from 1 to 14.
And then when 14 ended, you kind of saw the handwriting on the wall.
Yeah, there was talk about cutting back the space program, and that was when a friend of mine who worked for Sperry Univac, and he offered me that job. So I decided that I'd better get while the getting was good.
And then you made an interesting comment to me as we were exchanging our emails back and forth. You said that you didn't really give Apollo a second thought until after you retired.
Yeah, that's true.
You just kind of didn't look back.
Well, I put all of my memorabilia in a big suitcase, and I went to work on another program, and I just got totally consumed with it, and just never had much time to look back. I've done a lot of looking back since I retired, and what I remember. 5 or 6 years ago, maybe not that long, I put something on my Facebook page about having worked on the Apollo program. And one of the people that I had worked for in the FAA for years came back on Facebook and said, "Brian, I never knew that you worked on the space program." And I said, yes. I says, that's where I learned how to do things right.
You know, what I find interesting is the more people affiliated with Apollo that I talk to that moved on to other things. From an outsider's perspective, you know, the natural thought is that, gosh, what would it be like to hit the highlight of your career so early in life? You know, how do you top landing on the moon and being affiliated with that such heady deal? But so many of the technicians I talked to it was just part of my life and I moved on. And, well, you know, and I just find it interesting that there was no letdown after Apollo. It was what they had to do. They did it and then they moved on.
Well, you know, Jim, it gave me such a leg up having worked on Apollo. They had a big retirement party for me when I retired from the FAA. And of course I had to get up and give a little speech. And I remember telling all these FAA people, I said, back before I came to work for the FAA, I put 6 men on the moon. And looking back now, everything I've ever done since then is all this stuff I've done since then has just been a bunch of stuff. And it didn't, that was when it first started occurring to me that everything I did after the space program was just a bunch of stuff.
Just a bunch of everyday things.
Just a bunch of stuff is all it was. And I used to have this inside joke with some of my close friends at work in the later years. I would see people who worked around me and worked for me who were doing less than stellar work. And I would just make the comment. I said, we'd never have put a man on the moon with this kind of a performance. And people who didn't work on the space program have no appreciation of what I meant. But we had to do things out to great detail, and that's where I learned to take things out, like 10 decimal points. And the old saying, measure twice and cut once,
mm-hmm.
and make sure that you get it done right the first time.
My best friend's father used to always say to us whenever we'd work on a project, his favorite thing to say to us was, you know, there's never enough time to do it right, but there's plenty of time to do it over.
Absolutely.
And that always stuck with me. That was like one of the biggest lessons he ever taught me, was to do it right the first time, you take left time.
Mm-hmm.
And so looking back for you, that letdown or that realization that Apollo was the highlight of your life, the highlight of your career, didn't really come right away. It came once your career was over and you were looking back on it and saying, oh yeah, okay, that was really big.
Yeah.
Do you think that's largely because you guys were just really too busy to stop and smell the roses and realize that the enormous gravity of what it is that you guys were actually doing, because you were in the middle of it and doing it?
I can only speak for myself, Jim. Let me put a little different frame around this picture for me. I went to Guam in the middle of the Vietnam War. And I went to Guam in the middle of all the civil rights riots that were going on here in the States. I don't know if you're old enough to remember those.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was born in 60. I was born in 61. So I was like 7, 8 during Apollo.
So picture, if you will, here are a bunch of us ex-GIs on Guam working on an Apollo tracking station. And there's a war going on in Vietnam. And we have all of the turmoil going on in America. Martin Luther King got murdered and Robert Kennedy got murdered. And all of our young men were getting murdered in Vietnam. And there was a huge, huge military presence on Guam. We had the Anderson Air Force Base out there. We had the Marine Barracks. There were some Army people. A huge Navy hospital that was full of walking wounded and severely wounded from Vietnam. And Guam was also an R&R site for the guys in Vietnam who couldn't afford to go to Hawaii, I guess. I don't know why the hell they would go to Guam if they could go anywhere else. But at any rate, we had all this stuff going on, and Guam was crawling with GIs on crutches, and we used to go up and visit them at the hospital. Some of the stuff that we were doing just didn't seem any more important than what everybody else was involved in. Can you hang on just a minute, please?
Sure.
I've got to let my wife in.
That's okay.
Okay, I'm sorry, I'm back. I had my wife locked out.
That's
okay.
So
just a little in parentheses here. One day I wrecked a motorcycle, and I was on crutches and going from bar to bar, And the cab drivers would pick me up and give me a free ride because they thought I was a GI. No kidding. And here I am. And it just, the enormity of what's going on just kind of struck me. I said, here I am. I have the job of a lifetime. I'm having a wonderful time. And these guys are getting shot and they're getting killed. And back home, they're burning the cities down. So I had to put what I was doing in context with everything else that was going on. And I was having fun. So I guess I was just immature enough. I didn't appreciate the enormity of being involved in the greatest achievement in the history of mankind. And so it wasn't until later in life that I looked back and I started putting all the pieces together and started making sense out of what we were doing.
So you've seen in over the course of your career, you've seen an enormous technological development that was largely fueled by NASA itself, from those heady UNIVAC computers all the way to the personal computer era that we have now and everything that's powering it. And I tend to believe that if you really want to know where we're headed in the future, talk to the guys that blaze the trail, because they have a singular perspective. So from your perspective and looking at the development of computer technology and looking at your Apollo experience, where do you see our manned spaceflight program going? Do you think there's a future for us that we're just kind of in a lull right now? Or do you think our best days are ahead of us? Or do you think our best days are ahead of us, or was Apollo pretty much the golden age?
I think Apollo was the golden age as far as manned spaceflight is concerned, as we know it. I really believe that the future of any space exploration is going to be done by guys like Elon Musk and the guy that owns Virgin Airlines. Mm-hmm. And those guys, I know that sounds like heresy, but this country, the shape we're in right now, we simply can't afford to continue spending billions of dollars on a space program like we used to. I don't think there's any public sentiment for it, for one thing. And I think that, based on my experience, we keep talking about NASA, quote unquote, but for the most part, all of this stuff was accomplished by private industry with NASA sponsorship and federal tax money. So I don't see much of a future in that business model. I think it's all going to be done by private enterprise.
So you think that if we do land on Mars, it'll probably be more of a private mission?
I think so.
Rather than, you'll see a company flag being stuck in the Martian landscape and not a country flag.
Probably.
Or at least an international flag.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think we'll ever see another space race where a country will take it'll be an international effort to if we ever go to Mars.
And really, I personally don't have anything wrong with I don't see anything wrong with that approach. I really don't.
No, there's nothing.
We're all here on Earth together.
So we might as well go together.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, well, Brian, I really appreciate you taking the time to join us here on Conversations with Apollo. My guest has been Brian Real. He was a computer technician who worked on the Apollo manned space flight network. Brian, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You've been listening to Conversations with Apollo. For more information, visit our website at www.apollotalks.com. Got a question or comment? There's several ways to get a hold of us. Drop us a line at apollotalks@gmail.com. You can leave us feedback on the iTunes website. You can now tweet us on Twitter @@ApolloTalks. And we're also on Facebook with Apollo Talks. Theme music is from Gemini 5, courtesy of the MySpace Music Network. The song is Babylon Rockets. Visit them on the web at www.gemini5, that's FIVE.com. Conversations with Apollo is a copyrighted podcast under the Creative Commons license from Quindar Entertainment. Copyright 2009.